From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation or on the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Bell Witch Project. Here's what's happening. A story we have been channeling, pushing, championing for years. Listen to this. New concerns are being raised about the nation's electrical grid and critical infrastructure increasingly vulnerable to a catastrophic foreign attack amid speculation now over whether officials are eyeing a former Cold War bunker inside a Colorado mountain as a shield against such a strike. North American Aerospace Defense Command is looking for ways to protect itself in the event of a massive electromagnetic pulse or EMP attack, a deliberate burst of energy that could disrupt the electrical grid and cripple NORAD's ability to defend the nation. Listen to what Peter Pry, the executive director of the EMP Task Force, which is a bipartisan congressional commission, has to say about this. What could it do? It could black out the U.S. electric grid for a protracted period of months or years, he says. 9 out of 10 Americans could die from starvation, disease, social collapse if the blackout lasted a year. Folks, we've been talking about this for years. It is a major story, and all we need to do is get Congress to approve funds to insulate the grid. It's almost that simple. Peter Pry said a $700 million contract to upgrade electronics inside Colorado's Cheyenne Mountain facility may provide a clue about just how worried the military is about such a threat. I've been warning people for years, and it's good to know that at least some people in government are beginning to take heed. Federal agents for years monitored one of the two gunmen who were shot dead after opening fire with assault rifles at a heavily guarded Texas exhibit of caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad near Dallas. Two government sources who asked not to be named said the shooters were roommates, Elton Simpson and Nadir Sufi of Phoenix. Court documents show that Simpson had been under surveillance for about 7-8 years and was convicted in 2011 of lying to FBI agents over his desire to join violent jihad in Somalia. FBI agents and police searched the two men's home in the Autumn Ridge Apartments in north central Phoenix, cordoning off the complex and evacuating residents for several hours in the early morning. In Iran, hairstyles of a spiky and unorthodox nature have reportedly been banned in Iran because they are implying of devil worshiping, while tattoos and other male bodily adornments are also being outlawed there. The internet could face an imminent capacity crunch, as we reported last night, as soon as in 8 years, should it fail to provide faster data, according to scientists in the United Kingdom. The cables and fiber optics that deliver the data to users will have reached their limit by 2023. Just how bad is this potential situation? Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet. Lauren, what do you think? How bad is it?
I think I'm more worried about what I'm going to have for lunch tomorrow.
Aha.
Actually.
So you're not concerned.
I am not concerned. If you look at this from a historical standpoint, going back to the beginning of all of this network work and ARPANET and the beginnings of the internet, these kinds of the sky is falling predictions have been just appearing on a routine basis. I mean, every few years you hear there's not going to be enough capacity, Everything's going to collapse. There's always enough capacity. It means work, it means money, but you know, it's so hard to predict what's going to be coming down the line in terms of improvements. I mean, you know, every time you turn around, it seems like you're hearing, for example, that fiber optic systems, they thought they'd reached the limit. Oh, they just found a way to triple them again.
Yeah.
And so I would be reluctant to make predictions of major problems like that even 2 years in advance or 3 years in advance. But, you know, going out 8 years, there's no telling what it's going to look like except for the fact that we're not going to just be sitting here and letting bad things happen. Now, having said that...
Aha, here it is, the caveat.
There is a caveat here. There is a proviso. And that is that if we don't get our act together in terms of having real competition with the internet and leave all of this in the hands of the big dominant ISPs like Comcast, mm-hmm. like AT&T, like Verizon, they don't necessarily have our best interests at heart. They tend to what I was just reading just before we went on the air that Comcast apparently spent over $300 million on the merger that failed.
On the merger that failed, you're
right. That was money just flushed down the toilet for outside consultants and all sorts of things like that. Now, that was money they could have been using to upgrade the network. So now they're going to have to get it from someone else. Who will that someone else be? Well, you know, it'll be the Comcast subscribers. So one way or another, the networks will be upgraded, but it's going to cost us more and more because there just isn't real competition that would drive down the costs like it has in so many other countries. So the internet's not going to shut down, but yeah, we could be paying for it, you know, through the wallet and through the nose.
Lauren, I always love your advice. Thank you so much. Lauren Weinstein. A Chinese man who reportedly collapsed after a 14-day internet gaming marathon, 14 days, asked paramedics who arrived to treat him to turn on his computer so he could continue surfing the web. Unbelievable. A string of moderate earthquakes has rattled the East Bay area of California, shaking buildings. There are no immediate reports of injuries, of course. There was a magnitude 4 and then another smaller one, a 3.6. It was a full moon, but lots of things have been going on. So let's check in with the expert, Stan Deo, his website, standeo.com. Stan, they're talking about the big one in California, and we're getting these swarms. What do you think?
Well, what I usually look for, not only is this look for the swarms, but across the ocean about 6,500 miles away, I look at New Guinea, because that's where we see big earthquakes on the western side of the Ring of Fire. When it has a big earthquake, like it did to, New Guinea had one about 4 hours ago, 7.5, it looks like.
That's a good size.
Yeah. Now, the shockwave from that, traveling across the Pacific through Hawaii and over to our west coast near the Juan de Fuca Plate, would take around 10 to 11 hours, roughly. And that shockwave would then perhaps release a major quake that's building, you know, pressure-wise along the California coast or Oregon or the Juan de Fuca. Now, we already know that there's been a magma eruption in the Juan de Fuca, like a volcano that spewed up, you know, a lot of matter there on the Juan de Fuca plate. And it didn't reach the surface, but it still made a nice ridge undersea for the volcano. And then, as you mentioned, we had that the Richter 4.3, I think it was, at near Ferndale in the last couple of days. Now, seeing those earthquakes, seeing the volcano erupting there, tells me that plate is weakening, you know, rapidly. And so people will look at New Guinea and that area of the Ring of Fire when you see a large earthquake, about a 6.5 or better, count about 10 hours ahead. And in our case here, that would be about 6 o'clock, tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Okay, look for an earthquake possibly hitting along the west coast of significance. If it's building like I think it is, we'll see that. It's just an estimated guess, not a prophecy.
Well, okay, but if it happens, Stan, you're coming back on tomorrow.
Well, I guess so. You remember one time when I was down in Australia doing a show with Art way back in the old days, and I was talking to him about earthquakes and, you know, the forecast map for the day. And it did show there would be an earthquake in the next 7 days after that over in Japan. And, you know, we went on talking, and about an hour passed, and the engineer, producer, broke in and said, wait, guys.
I remember that.
You remember? Right. And the earthquake hit Japan that I was predicting.
That's
there.
That's right. So, all right. Well, keep your eyes on it. Stan, thanks so much. Stan's website again, Stan Deo, D-E-Y-O.com. He does a great job for us and for, of course, everybody else who goes to his website. Credit cards can carry more than high interest rates. They actually might increase your chances of depression. Here's why. Well, it's common sense that high levels of debt can stress you out. Now researchers have found a statistically significant link between short-term household debt, such as credit card debt and overdue bills, and increases in the symptoms of depression. So try to get that debt taken care of. You won't be that depressed. Up next, we're going to talk about the web of debt with Ellen Brown and also her latest work, Forbidden Medicine. two incredible stories next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. About a week ago, we were going to have Ellen Brown on, and that's when the Baltimore riots broke out, and she was gracious enough to let us move her. Ellen is the founder of the Public Banking Institute, author of a dozen books, hundreds of articles. She's developed her skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in the Los Angeles area, best-selling book called Web of Debt, and of course, her latest, Forbidden Medicine, is effective non-toxic cancer treatment being suppressed? We're going to talk with her about both subjects. And Ellen, thanks again for letting us push you away for a little bit during those riots. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, George.
When you wrote The Web of Debt, which the subheading is The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free, tell me your thoughts about that, because lots of people feel as if we are being strangled by the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, well, that is the subject of that book. What I was writing about was the fact that, or the shocking truth that I was writing about was the fact that our money is not created by the government, as most people think. Virtually all of our circulating money supply is created by private banks when they make loans. And that includes the Federal Reserve, which is composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the private banks in their district. They actually get a 6% dividend guaranteed every year. And so they compose, and the Federal Reserve itself only composes, or dollars themselves are only like 3% of the money supply, dollars and coins. So what you have left are is credit created by banks. And this is, most people think that banks are lending their deposits. That's not true. The Bank of England just came out with a directive a year ago in which they said, contrary to popular belief, banks do not lend their deposits. They create deposits when they make loans. So what they do is they essentially double their money. Your deposits are still there. You never go into the bank and the banker says, I'm sorry, you'll have to wait for 30 years to get your deposits because we have lent them to your neighbor. They are always able to get them, and the reason is that they can borrow very cheaply from each other. So in effect, they borrow back the very money that they just created that perhaps went into another bank.
It's a great scheme, isn't it, Ellen?
It is, and it, basically we're renting our money that should be our money. It should be created by the government for the benefit of the public. The interest should be something that can be spent on public goods and services. That was the system that the American colonists had, and it was a brilliant system. They issued paper scrip. They didn't have money. They didn't have gold, and they didn't want to borrow from the Bank of England. And in fact, there weren't that many banks around to borrow from. So in 1691, the governor of Massachusetts needed money to fight a war, and he couldn't, it was a little border war, and he couldn't find anyone to borrow from. So he devised this clever system of doing these paper receipts that were basically acknowledging that the soldiers had done service for the people, and that then those receipts traded in the community as negotiable instruments. And what allowed them to retain their value was the fact that they were accepted in the payment of taxes. So in effect, they were advances against the payment of taxes owed by the people. And that system worked really well. One problem was that governments tended to print more money than they collected back in taxes. So they did, in some colonies, they did inflate the money supply, which devalued the currency. But in Pennsylvania, they came up with this very clever system where that was Benjamin Franklin's colony. And there they owned a bank, a land bank. It was called a land bank, supposedly backed by land. So the government would print a certain amount of currency and then lend it to the people. And then they would print a little extra. So let's say you printed, hypothetically, say you printed $105 and you lent $100 at 5% interest. And then you spent the $5 on things the government needed, roads and bridges and so forth, then you would have $105 out there in the economy to pay principal and interest. So you could lend the same $100, spend the same $5, over and over, and you wouldn't have to keep increasing the money supply. It was a totally sustainable system. So during the time that that system was in place, they paid no taxes except an excise tax on liquor, which was more of a penalty tax.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't much. The government did not go into debt, and the prices did not inflate. So it was an ideal system for that period, very sustainable.
Would it work today?
It would work today, but I've calculated it out. If you figure all the money that banks, let's say just hypothetically, that all the banks were publicly owned. I mean, I know we'd be a long way from that. I mean, what I'm recommending is that every state have one bank that's publicly owned. We have one state that has a bank that's the Bank of North Dakota. North Dakota is the only state that escaped the credit crisis. They've been in the black ever since 2008 and had a very nice profit. They have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate on credit card debt, one of the lowest foreclosure rates. There are just many great things happening in North Dakota. And they use that. So they're basically using their own credit for their own purposes. And North Dakota is a very Republican state. So from their perspective, it's not a socialist engine. It's a sovereignty.
Who came up with that concept for them?
Well, in 1919, they were going through a depression where the farmers were losing their farms basically to a Rockefeller bank. So it was a Rockefeller bank, a Rockefeller railroad, and a Rockefeller granary. It was
a nice monopoly going on there, huh?
Yeah, and they realized that the granary was not taking their grain, although it was perfectly good grain. And so they realized that there was an actual attempt to get their farms, which they were foreclosing
mm-hmm.
right and left on.
Squeeze them as much as you could, right?
Yeah. So they decided they wanted to keep their money in the state and use it for their own purposes. So the model was set up. There was a populist movement there. They had a very charismatic leader who got the people all excited, and they formed what was called the Nonpartisan League, and they managed to win an election, and then they set up their banks. So the way the model was that by law, all of the revenues of the state were deposited in the Bank of North Dakota, and that's still true today. So that's a huge deposit base, and they are not FDIC insured because virtually their entire deposit base is the state itself. They don't
right.
want to
They're
be
basically
FDIC.
Self-insured.
Yeah, and they don't. If they were FDIC insured, they'd be paying huge premiums to bail out other banks in other states. So they don't need that. And they would put themselves under the jurisdiction of the FDIC, which is basically controlled by big banks because they're the big, they pay the big premiums to the FDIC.
You know, Ellen, when you try to go into a bank today to withdraw your money, it's like red tape. I mean, they don't want to give it to you. They do eventually, but I mean, it's like pulling teeth.
Mm-hmm.
How come?
I think partly they're trying to nail anybody who's not paying taxes. So let's say you're pulling out big amounts in cash. It's probably because you're doing something that you're not going to pay taxes on. So that's why they're trying to track it. But also the banks are.
Well, you probably paid the taxes on it when you got it in the first place, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, but you're paying it to someone else who doesn't want to pay taxes.
I'm guessing.
Okay. I don't know.
Maybe.
But also, there's this whole thing toward digitalization of the money supply. They want to get rid of cash.
Cash.
For example, at the Flyaway, which is a public bus system here in L.A., you can't use cash. I mean, it's supposedly cash is a legal tender, but you're required to use a credit card.
That's what they want.
That's going to be the system of the future, I think, that it's all going to be electronic.
And according to my last story, if you use your credit card too much, you get depressed.
Right.
You look at that. But stay with us, Ellen. We're going to take this quick break and come back. We'll talk a little bit more about this. Then I want to get into forbidden medicine. Is effective non-toxic cancer treatment being suppressed? Think about that. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Ellen Brown with us. Ellen, let's wrap up talking about this. So how do we break free? How do we get away from a system that apparently has all of us ensnared?
Well, the private banking system acts rather as a parasite on the system. It's sucking the profits out that should be going back to the people, for the things that people expect from government. So the way we could get it back, ideally, would be at the federal level, just as the American colonists did. You could either nationalize the Federal Reserve so that it's actually the Treasury that's issuing the money. Right now, the Federal Reserve acts as a bank. So although it creates the money and it's theoretically federal, we know it's not actually, and it's not actually acting on behalf of the people. But the Federal Reserve could be issuing money directly to Congress to spend on goods and services. That's not the way it is right now. Right now, the Federal Reserve lends money into the system just like any other bank. So it's just a bank. It's a lending institution. So you could have the Treasury issue the money. The Treasury could issue coins. It could issue a $1 trillion coin. The president could do that by executive order, and that was something that's been discussed. Actually, I broached that when I first published Web of Debt in 2007, that you could solve your problems that way. And then when we had the debt ceiling, that somebody heard me say that on a radio show and thought that was a good idea. So it originally was just sort of a hypothetical joke sort of response to the debt ceiling, but then some economists started taking it seriously, and Paul Krugman said it was a good idea, that the government has the power to issue money. It's in the Constitution. Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. But the only coins that they do issue is about $1 billion worth out of a circulating money supply that's over $10 trillion. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very small portion of the money supply. In the 19th century, coins were actually half the money supply. So it's half privately issued, half publicly issued. But now it's almost nothing. But they could do that again. They would have to do the platinum coin, because in the 1980s, Congress passed legislation limiting the amount of silver, nickels, dimes, quarters, etc., that could be issued. But they left the platinum coin, which was a commemorative coin, they left that one open. So if the president needed to counteract the debt ceiling, which we actually hit in March again, and they're already doing finagling, you know, where they're borrowing from the pension funds and so forth to make it look like they're not over the debt ceiling, they could get around it that way. But since Congress is pretty much deadlocked, it's unlikely, actually, that things are going to happen right away at the federal level. So the other option, and the one I pushed in the Public Bank Solution, which I'm afraid I have to correct you, that's actually my latest book, in the Public Bank Solution, was to follow the Bank of North Dakota model. So just as the Federal Reserve creates money in the form of loans, and all private banks create money in the form of loans, you could have a public bank creating money in the form of loans using the massive deposit base that all states have. For example, in California, the treasurer is in charge of an investment pool that has $60 billion in it that is currently earning 0.23% interest. It's earning almost nothing. You can't spend that money. It's being managed on behalf of different agencies and so forth. It's like rainy day funds and slush funds. But you could use that as your deposit base. You could deposit that money into your own state-owned bank. Then you can leverage that money, as all banks do. So now you've got $60 billion in credit. That's just new money.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, your $60 billion is still there. You haven't spent it. It's still there as deposits. And the way banking works is that if the depositors come for their money at the same time that you've lent it out or lent out an equivalent sum, then you borrow from other banks very cheaply at 0.25%.
So there could never be a run on you.
Right. So, I mean, it works for other banks. It could work for the state, and the state could be getting its infrastructure at half what they're paying now, because on average, 50% of the cost of infrastructure is interest and fees, bank fees. Just like on average, the cost of a mortgage is 50% interest. By the time you pay it out over 30 years, you paid as much again or more in interest as you would pay in principal.
Who's got to initiate, Ellen, a change? Who's got to start this?
Well, that's what we do at the Public Banking Institute, is try to get our legislators to do it. And we've got legislators that are interested in it. I've been working on it in California. There is hope. I actually ran for state treasurer on the Green Party ticket, and that was my platform. And I got more votes than any other third-party candidate for any of the offices. And through that, I was connected to John Chung, who actually is the state treasurer. So we're working on it now. I mean, I've had several meetings with him, and there's hope there.
All right, let's take some time to talk about your other work, then we'll take phone calls with you next hour. Forbidden Medicine. Tell me how you got involved with this.
Well, I was actually an attorney on the case. It was Jimmy Keller was probably the most popular of the Tijuana cancer healers in 1991. I had just gone on the Cancer Control Society tour and saw all the clinics, and they were pretty interesting until we got to the last one, and that one was really interesting. It was Jimmy Keller's, and it was like a religious revival. He put all these patients on who were giving, you know, testimonials of all the amazing things that had happened to him, and what a pleasant environment it was. And like going to the clinic was like going on vacation, unlike going to your ordinary cancer clinic where it's really horrible. You know, you come out feeling much worse than you went in. But this, you came out feeling better, and everybody was singing. I mean, I was a little skeptical at the time because, you know, it just seemed too good. But then later, one of Jimmy's patients called me and said, Jimmy's in jail. He needs somebody to represent him. And so, he already had attorneys, but he was suspicious of them. He thought they were throwing the case. They were constitutional law attorneys from Texas. So he was basically kidnapped by the FBI, taken across the border, sent to Brownsville, Texas, where he was tried for the alleged fraud of when somebody working with him represented that he had a high rate of cure for cancer, or high rate of success. They didn't even say cure. You know, it's illegal to say cure if you're not an MD.
That's right.
Which he wasn't. Well,
they crack down on you if you say that. That's for sure.
But he had MDs working for him, and it was quite... He wasn't in trouble with the Tijuana authorities. It was the Louisiana people that had come for him. So I sat through, at the time I was living abroad, and I told him I couldn't do it. But then I met another attorney who did that sort of work and wanted to team up on it. So we did it, and I sat through the whole trial, and I spent 7 years working on the whole thing and talking to Jimmy a lot in jail, and I represented him on his appeal, which I lost, I'm afraid. But so he spent 4 years in jail, 2.5 years the first time, and then he was on probation, but he wasn't allowed to leave Louisiana. And, of course, his patients came and wanted to be treated, and how could he say no, et cetera. So he did, and they caught him breaking his probation. And spent another year and a half in jail. But anyway, he had cancer himself when he was 33, and they'd cut off his ear, and it was malignant melanoma. They cut off his ear, cut the muscles in his face, and after they'd pretty much totally disfigured him, they told him that it was terminal and there's nothing more they could do, and they were going to try radiation. And he said, well, I thought you told me radiation wasn't going to work. And they said, well, we don't have anything else. So he was so depressed. Of course, he didn't do it. He didn't do the radiation, but his parents talked him into going to the Hoxie Clinic, which was an herbal treatment.
Yep. Before they tried to shut all them down, too.
And lo and behold, it actually, he started getting better, and he was so amazed because nobody had told him that there were any alternatives like that. So he got into all the alternatives. He experimented like crazy, and he was cured. I mean, I guess you could say cured. He lived for another 40 years after that, and he didn't die of cancer. He actually died of a stroke.
Did you believe his story, Ellen? I know
did.
You represented him.
But I did, totally. And I believed his patients. I mean, I heard a lot of his patients, and Yeah, it was sincere. And he had a 50% success rate with terminal stage 4 cancers that oncologists were having a 4% rate of.
See, yeah, you got to look at the data.
Yeah, and he was having 80% success with the others.
What would he do? I mean, again, you can't say it was a cure, but what was he attempting on people?
Yeah, well, the reason he was so successful was that he basically, what they convicted him for was the thing that was that made him so successful, and that was radionics. That he tested every patient every day to find out where the weaknesses were in the system. That's what radionics does. It's a biophoton machine that detects the energy patterns from this biophoton energy that's given off by the cells, a very weak form of energy that now, you know, I think you probably had people on talking about this, but Fritz Popp and David Wilcock.
David's on a lot.
So it's all that. So now it's quite popular and quite well known, but in the 90s, it looked like quackery. Here was this radionics machine, and he had actually, for example, put people's photographs on it and said that he could treat at a distance, and that was just such blatant quackery to this jury. But it actually works. And I mean, I know personally that works because I've seen it work. I mean, it's worked in my own family and myself. So,
I mean, let's get the, if you can though, because I'm curious about it. Did they ever publish? Did he ever publish what he did?
What I've said in the book, I mean, I have it from his son, what was in his serum.
His ingredients.
Tell people privately, but it's, you know.
So you won't do it publicly.
It's an injectable serum, and the base of it, well, I think I can say basically what it is. The base of it was arginine and histidine, so it was like 75% arginine, 25% histidine.
Amino acids.
Yeah, and so they were immune stimulants, stimulating the immune system, and then he added different things depending on what your particular condition was. So it's like vitamin C, GH3, which is basically Novocaine. I mean, there a lot of it was energetic remedies. Like GH3 works by resetting the body, so that it's like a tuning fork where it's like Novocaine. And sort of numbs the body and puts you back. It's like,
Well, L-arginine is great for your, it's a vascular dilator too. It really like kicks open your nitrous oxide. It's good for your heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So it worked really well, but particularly it worked because he tuned it to the particular patient.
Now, did he eventually just simply stop helping people, or did he do it quietly? What happened?
No, he did it quietly, and then he got busted. Well, then he continued after he was released. He did continue treating people.
If you don't charge people money for it, is it an offense?
Well, he did charge, but he was charging less than anyone else, and I mean, and if you couldn't pay, he didn't charge you. So,
how did he learn this?
Over many years, he just explored and explored, and he was down there in Tijuana, so of course he was able to learn what the others knew. One of the things he used was live cell therapy, which it was sort of the forerunner of stem cell therapy, and he thought was better than stem cell therapy. You didn't need it. In the 90s, the stem cell therapy involved human fetuses, and he said there was no need to go for human fetuses. The Germans had been doing this for 100 years, and it was they used the fetuses of sheep and cows, and it was the same thing, that they're like the primitive baby cells, so you would use heart cells or kidney cells or whatever the organ was that was out of tune, and it would basically retune it. It's like a tuning fork. And he did that on me, and I had a remarkable reversal. I was all lined up for surgery, and I canceled my surgery. I didn't need it.
Helen, all around the country, the FDA and government has cracked down on practitioners who claim to be able to help people. and they're going after them viciously, you know, convicting some, putting them, you know, putting them in jail, going after some. I know Robert Young, his trials going on now where, you know, he claims that he's been able to help people cure cancer. He's a proponent of balancing your body with the proper pH levels. But, you know, I don't know the particulars of his case, but they seem to go after people who go against mainstream medicine or big pharma. Is that pretty accurate?
It's totally accurate, and I think it's getting worse. That's why I actually came out with a second edition of Forbidden Medicine, and that was why. It just seemed to me that you don't even hear about the alternatives anymore. I mean, it used to be in the you know, last half of the last century, people would go down to Tijuana, and you talked about it, and you could find practitioners who would do things, and now it's just totally, literally forbidden, I mean, literally illegal. Or if you go, say, Brzezinski, Dr. Brzezinski in Texas, you have to first get chemotherapy and radiation, so they have to not work before you're allowed to go for alternative treatment. Well, that means that you've already destroyed your immune system, so they're not nearly as likely to work. And that's also true in Tijuana, and that was one reason they went after Jimmy. We had that from National Council Against Health Fraud records that they had targeted him because he was popular and he wasn't an MD, although he had MDs working for him. And they wanted to close down. They wanted to force those clinics to use chemotherapy and radiation. There was a belt on the border that was under joint jurisdiction of U.S. and Mexico. And so the U.S. was able to impose their regulations. And so the regulation was and is now that you have to have gone through conventional therapy and it has to have failed before you can go for alternative.
What's the future for alternative medicine?
Well, I think that it will prevail. I mean, the whole energy medicine thing is so clearly right, and if you've ever experienced it, it just works so much better, and you don't have to go through those toxic side effects. The difference between alternative and conventional is that conventional medicine is toxic to the body, and it works by trying to, well, for cancer, it's trying to kill the cancer, hopefully to kill the cancer before it kills the patient, whereas alternative treatment or natural treatment supports the body, supports the immune system. And the theory is, for example, one theory, Otto Warburg came out with a Nobel Prize winning explanation of cancer in the 1930s, where he said it was normal cells that had gone anaerobic. They've been deprived of oxygen because of toxins or something that's blocking them from getting the blood, the oxygen through the blood, and so they turn anaerobic, which means that they feed on sugars and they don't want oxygen. So ideally what you want to do is turn those back into normal cells, which can be done, and that's what these bio-photon-type bioenergetic treatments do, is they retune the cells so that they can use the oxygen again and they become normal cells.
You know, you would think, Ellen, that major facilities, the Mayo Clinics and places like that, would look at things like what Jimmy Keller did and at least try it. We'll be back. Ellen Brown with us. We're going to open up the phone line, so we'll talk about, of course, the web of debt and forbidden medicine.